Well, we stopped after slide 11. And slide 12, we're talking about the cell cycle in this chapter. Slide 12 has to do with control of the cell cycle. So I've already described what the cell cycle is, what it consists of. But it's really important for a cell to be able to control the cell cycle. Specifically, it's important for a multicellular organism that has, of course, multiple cells by definition, to control the cell cycle for its individual cells. And it makes sense to assume, I mean, it's rational to assume that there is some sort of chemical involved in controlling the cell cycle. But of course, in science, you can't just assume something simply because it makes sense. You have to demonstrate it. So this slide shows you the results of an experiment designed to determine whether there is a chemical basis for the control of the cell cycle. And in the first of the experiments, they used a cell that was in the S phase. And remember where that is. S is part of what? Major subphase. Interphase, right. Interphase has G1, then S, then G2. So S is in the middle of interphase. And then another cell that's in G1, which is earlier, right? S is where what happens in S? DNA replication. G1 is earlier than that. So this cell on the right of experiment 1 is earlier than in the cell cycle than the S1 is. And then they experimentally fused the two cells into one cell, as you see. And what they noticed when they did that is that the nucleus, the half of the cell corresponding to the earlier separate G1 cell, immediately went into the S phase. The nucleus started DNA replication. And so that by itself agrees with the assumption that there is a chemical basis, right? It looks like there is some sort of chemical present in the S cell that caused the formerly G1 cell to proceed to the next part of the cell cycle. But the far more convincing evidence is from experiment 2, in which case they took an M cell. So this one is already done with interphase. It's in the M phase, which is the mitotic phase. And they fused it with a G1. So those are opposite ends of the entire cell cycle, right? G1 is just getting started. M is just ending. And when they fused these two together, the former G1 nucleus immediately started trying to undergo mitosis, even though it really can't, because it skipped over S, which is where the replication occurs, and mitosis separates the two copies. Well, you can't separate two copies if you don't even have two copies. But this nucleus thought it was time to go into the M phase, and so that's really strong evidence that there's a chemical basis. Now, it doesn't say what it is, but it tells you that there is chemical control over the cell cycle. Let's look at the cell cycle in schematic form in slide 13. This kind of shows it by analogy with a lamp timer. Right? You have, depending on what brand you get, lamp timers have little, usually red things that you put into them that turn the thing on or off at a certain time of day. Well, these red things in this cartoon are labeled as checkpoints. They're not actually structures. A checkpoint is a set of chemical conditions that have to be met in order for a cell to be able to proceed from one part of the cell cycle to the next part. In other words, to get past the checkpoint. And if those conditions don't exist, then the cell will stay in whatever phase it's in and not get past the checkpoint until those conditions are met. And you can see that there's important checkpoints like the G1 checkpoint. This makes sense that there would be a checkpoint between G1 and S. Or hopefully to you it makes sense. And that's because G1 is the normal lifetime of that cell, right? It's busy being that kind of cell. It's not appropriate to go to the next phase until this cell is actually ready to split into two, because that's what the rest of the cell cycle is all about, preparation for dividing. So the G1 checkpoint is an important checkpoint, an important set of conditions that have to be met in order for this cell to proceed. And similarly, G2 and M are important. Slide 14 shows you that for most cells, a lot of cells, the G1 checkpoint is eventually met, meaning those conditions are met. The chemicals, the certain mixture of chemicals is there for it to proceed. So it gets the green light in a sense. There are some cells, though, that actually never pass the G1 checkpoint. And they are permanently in what is called G0, although it really is G1. It's just that they can't get out of G1 because the conditions are never met. For instance, in your own body, a typical neuron is going to be in G0. It doesn't divide, which is why, you know, nerve damage results in permanent damage, because they can't repair themselves under normal circumstances. And unlike a lot of your cells in your body, they'll last an entire lifetime until they die, which could be before you die. But on the other hand, a skin cell, for instance, those pretty easily get to the G1 checkpoint. They have to, right? Because simply living makes you lose millions of skin cells every day. Just a breeze on your skin will blow off millions of dead skin cells. If you don't replace those at the same rate that you lose them, of course you'll run out of skin, and that will kill you pretty quickly, because the skin saves your life every day for multiple reasons. Anyway, there are always dividing skin cells to create new copies of skin cells that then migrate to the surface and become the dead ones that you can touch. But the amount that's added equals roughly the amount that are lost, and so you maintain your skin thickness. So those skin cells have a pretty short G1, and they reach this G1 checkpoint pretty easily and then prepare to divide and go on to divide. Neurons are like part B of this. All right, so I don't want to get too bogged down in the details of the control, but slide 15 shows you part of what we know. And one reason I don't want to get bogged down into it is because we're still learning how the control of the cell cycle works. But this slide is just a little piece of what we know. I just want to demonstrate how the chemical situation can actually control the cell cycle. So the top is actually multiple cell cycles. The bottom, of course, is one cell cycle, as you see. But you see the initials corresponding to the major subphases, G1, S, G2, and then M. Those are listed up here, so you can see that it's multiple cell cycles. And that top figure is a graph. It's two graphs in one, really. There's a purple trace and a pinkish trace. For the purple trace, the y-axis is MPF activity. Well, what is MPF other than an acronym? It stands for mitogen promoting factor. Now the gen, well, first of all, factor. You have a lot of things in biology that are called factors. Factors are proteins of various sorts. So growth factor, for instance, is a protein. Well, mitogen promoting factor is a protein, a protein complex. The gen of mitogen, like in Genesis or generate, means create. And so a mitogen is something that brings about, creates, or induces mitosis, meaning cell division in eukaryotes. All right, now, so MPF activity for this purplish trace means how much this MPF factor, this protein, is working. And notice that it's usually low. It gets high in the M phase. In fact, that's what causes the M phase. The other trace, though, this pinkish one, is for cyclin concentration. That's what the y-axis represents for that one. And cyclin, as you can see on the bottom, well, I guess you can't see it from the cartoon. It's drawn this way. But cyclin is itself a protein. It gets its name because it gradually builds up. You can see this in the trace. In late S, cyclin starts to accumulate in the cell each cycle. So the cell builds more and more cyclin. All right. There's also, though, as you see in the bottom, in lighter purple, still another protein called CDK. CDK is an, it should be actually all caps, but it's not. CDK stands for cyclin dependent kinase. So right away you know it is what? It is an enzyme. Kinase tells you that it's an enzyme, but kinase is not a specific enzyme. Kinase is a huge category of enzymes. There's all kinds of kinases, including this one. This is just one of them. But kinases as a category are enzymes that all of which work by phosphorylating some other protein. Now, I've already discussed, starting in the back when we were talking about functional groups, that phosphorylation and dephosphorylation, in other words, adding a phosphate to something or taking it off of something, is a major way that cells are able to switch on or switch off proteins. You can activate or deactivate by either phosphorylating or dephosphorylating, depending on the protein that's being phosphorylated or dephosphorylated. And I mentioned that originally because I said it's useful in the control of pathways, biochemical pathways, to be able to control the pathways by controlling the enzymes by switching them on or off rather than by creating them and destroying them. Right? You could destroy an enzyme to shut down a pathway, but if you need it turned back on the next minute, you're going to have to build a new one, which is expensive and time-consuming. So it's much better if you can switch them on and off quickly. And you can do that by phosphorylation and dephosphorylation. That's why there are so many enzymes whose job, specific job it is to either phosphorylate some specific protein somewhere. And that's true for this CDK enzyme. But it gets its name because this is an enzyme, the cyclin-dependent kinase, that is normally not active. It doesn't work as an enzyme, even though it is an enzyme. It's turned off unless cyclin, which is a different protein, binds to the cyclin-dependent kinase, and that's why it's called cyclin-dependent kinase. Cyclin is the thing that turns on cyclin-dependent kinase, all right? So once you have the two together, CDK and cyclin, those two together make up mitogen-promoting factor. That's when it's in its active form. And what this means now is that cyclin-dependent kinase, which is an enzyme, is turned off until cyclin comes along and binds to it. Now it's turned on, and now it is a kinase, which means it's able to do its job as a kinase of phosphorylating something else. And the something else that it phosphorylates is a different enzyme in a biochemical pathway. All right? So cyclin turns on cyclin-dependent kinase, which then turns on another enzyme that has the effect of satisfying the checkpoint allowing the cell to go on to the M phase. Now, let me explain the top graph. What happens is that cyclin-dependent kinase is always there. It's just that it's inactive if there's no cyclin to bind to it, okay? But it's CDK is there the whole time, as you can see here. That's not what's being graphed here. What's being graphed is MPF activity. Cyclin is not there all the time. Cyclin concentration is effectively zero up until the S phase, and that's when it starts to accumulate. So the cell starts making more and more cyclin. The more there is, the more likely it is that some of that cyclin will bind to CDK to turn on the CDK. To turn on the CDK, in other words, to turn into MPF. All right? And then once you have that, then that's the checkpoint, basically. That allows for the cell to move on through the cycle. But notice the crash in these pinkish ones. During the M phase, the cyclin concentration drastically drops. And that's because of what you see in the cartoon. After it's done its job of activating cyclin-dependent kinase and causing the cell to split, the cyclin gets degraded. It gets digested into amino acids and recycled. And that's why it has to start over, building up gradually through the next generation of cells in their own cell cycle until it starts activating more cyclin-dependent kinase in that cell. All right. That's part of control. 16 shows you a little bit more. Different example here, or actually a more specific example. If you remove fibroblasts, which are a kind of connective tissue cell, from an animal and put them in solution, so this solution is just keeping them alive, basically. You can plate them out, these little bottles, onto some sort of agar, just like in what you find in a petri dish. Well, this agar that you plate these things out on contains nutrients that will keep these cells alive. In both cases, the blue and the red one. The difference is that in addition to the contents that keeps the cells alive, which is in both bottles, the red bottle also has PDGF, which is another acronym, of course. That stands for platelet-derived growth factor. That's named for the fact that that's where we found it, in platelets, but it's not the only place that it exists. But growth factor is another factor, another protein, as I said. And the point here is that if you don't have PDGF in this bottle, like in the blue example, the cells will be kept alive because they have the nutrients they need, but they are not spurred on to go into cell division. They just exist. They just still live, but don't split. Whereas if they do have PDGF, then the cells proliferate, which means create new cells. They do that by splitting. So this is, in other words, evidence, more evidence of a chemical basis for the control of the cell cycle. All right. That's PDGF working by itself. Now, slide 17 uses another example. If you have isolated cells in a flask, like in that previous slide, you know, as long as you're giving them the correct stuff to stay alive, they'll stay alive. But certain kinds of cells, even if they have a chemical signal telling them that they should divide will still not divide if they are just in liquid. These kind of cells have what's called anchorage dependence. To be anchored means to be hooked to some surface. And so some cells have anchorage dependence beyond the need to have the correct chemical situation. They also have to actually be connected to a surface. So these kind of cells, if they have the chemical signal as the go-ahead, plus they can see that they can tell that they are connected to something, then they will start dividing. And not only that, they also exhibit what's called density-dependent inhibition. So what this means is that they have to be anchored to start dividing, and when they do, when they start dividing, that's going to fill up the spaces between the cells, right, on that surface. Just like healing skin, for instance. You put a hole in your skin, the cells have to fill in that hole. Well, density-dependent inhibition tells them to stop when they have filled the hole. So when there's enough cell division that all the spaces are filled, that shuts it off, and no more further cell division, which is appropriate, right? But if a cell has... Well, and by the way, in this little cartoon picture, you can scoop a little piece out after they've filled it up, and that will spur them on, the ones around the space, to divide to fill it up again. And then they'll stop again once it's filled. That's under normal circumstances, which depends on having the correct versions of DNA. But if a cell loses the ability to control the cell cycle, and it can lose that ability by having incorrect genes, abnormal genes, which are caused by mutations, then they've lost density-dependent inhibition. And when you lose the inhibition, which means to turn off, you lose the ability to turn off splitting. And they not only fill up the holes, but then they start piling up. That's exactly what a tumor is. So cancer is a genetic disorder. That doesn't mean it's heritable. Genetic simply means that genes are involved, DNA is involved. And mutations are changes to DNA. We'll talk more about those later. But if you damage DNA in genes that are involved in coding for proteins that are involved in control of the cell cycle, then the cell can lose the ability to control the cell cycle. And therefore, it thinks that it's supposed to split when it really shouldn't. We'll keep going through the cell cycle. Now, and that's what cancer starts as. A single cell that has mutated in some gene involved in the cell cycle. And it will think that it's appropriate to go quickly through the cell cycle and split again. That's one defective cell. But notice, remember what happens in mitosis. You create two genetically identical cells from that one that splits, right? Therefore, if you start with one defective cell, when it splits, you now have two defective cells, and they both think that they're supposed to split immediately. And this is why it will grow into a tumor. It starts as one cell and becomes visibly big after a while. This is also, by the way, why cancer is so much more prevalent the longer you live. Because you've given that DNA that you were born with longer and longer to undergo damage from various things in the environment. You know, sunlight, there's all kinds of things that cause mutations, including just living. It's just random accidents or mutations. And that those accumulate, eventually leading to a cancer in a lot of people. Now the final slide, 18, I think this is the last slide, 18, shows you how cancer can progress. Cancer starts as a single cell that grows into a tumor, as I said. A tumor by itself doesn't necessarily cause any damage, doesn't really interfere with the things around it, early on at least, which is why early detection is so important. But eventually it can start interfering with the normal cells in whatever organ it's in to begin with. If the tumor is not removed or the cells of the tumor are not killed, then things can get much worse. The bigger a tumor gets, the more likely it is, simply because it's made of more and more cells, the bigger it gets. And they all have that defective gene, so they all think they're supposed to split. The more likely it gets for one or more of those cells to leave the tumor, take a ride in lymph or blood to go somewhere else in the body and start a new tumor somewhere else. This is how cancer metastasizes. That's called metastasis. And that's when it becomes harder and harder to deal with medically, and makes it more and more likely that a person will die from it. Yeah, that was the last slide. So let's change to another chapter.